Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Another major campaign promise from the NDP a year away from the next election. The New Democrats are promising parents if they form government in 2015, they'll bring the country $15 a day childcare. The NDP leader, Thomas Mulcair, is here to discuss his plan.
Is Justin Trudeau the candidate women have been waiting for? That's the question posed in an article in Chatelaine magazine that has created a bit of a controversy in Canadian politics, with some critics calling it patronizing. The author of the piece, Carol Toller, joins us to defend her article and address the criticism.
The Supreme Court has heard the arguments in a legal challenge to Canada's ban on assisted suicide. Our country's top judges gave the government a rough ride as it tried to keep the status quo. Conservative MP Stephen Fletcher, who's a quadriplegic, tells us why he's lobbying against his own party's position.
And the McLean's panel weighs in on Dipper Daycare and the controversy over the Trudeau profile in Chatelaine magazine.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. In an appeal to attract women voters, we saw two big stories this week. We'll deal with the Chatelaine article on Justin Trudeau in a few moments. But first, the NDP is continuing its campaign of making election promises a year before the scheduled vote. This time, though, it's making a big commitment to parents. New Democrats say if they form government, they'll bring in a $15 a day childcare program. The plan from the official opposition is to create 1 million childcare spaces over an 8-year period. The annual cost of maintaining these spots could rise to $5 billion by 2023, according to the party.
The Conservative government questions the cost of the proposed program, asking how the NDP would pay for it, and the Liberals say the math doesn't add up. To defend his party's plan for childcare, I'm joined now by NDP leader Thomas Mulcair. So, Tom, thanks for joining us. I guess, first of all, let's deal with the childcare proposal that you presented this week. One of the questions I've seen raised, Kevin Milligan, an economist in British Columbia, raised it on our website, was what conditions will be applied to the provinces? What will the expectations be for this funding? So in your mind, what exactly are you expecting the provinces to do, and what conditions will you put on the funding?
Well, what we've been saying since the beginning is we want Canadian parents to be paying at most $15 a day for this quality childcare. That would mean taking the provincial situation as it presents itself. Right now, there's a fairly elaborate system in Quebec, one that goes quite a long ways in Manitoba, and it varies a great deal from place to place. Take Ontario as an example. It's the only province with 2 full years of kindergarten. They have what they call junior K and senior K. You're not going to be dictating to a province what to do with that. We take that as it presents itself. We deal with their reality. So we're not talking about one size fits all. We're talking about sitting down with the provinces and territories and working this out. But we're convinced that we'll put an offer on the table, the 60-40 split, 60% being taken up by the federal government and 40 by the provinces, would mean that at the end of a first term, the vast majority of provinces would be on board. And that would be a very good thing because it's been 30 years that we've been talking about getting child care done, but nobody's gotten it done. And we plan to get to it from day one.
So is that to say there won't be any conditions beyond the price per day?
Well, we'd make sure that we're talking about quality child care as well. And it could, for example, some provinces might want to make sure that there's, for shift workers, a lot of nurses, for example, in larger downtown areas, you could have some child care available to help them out as well. And that exists in some places, but not too many. So these are the types of things we can be looking at. But what we do know is right now in Ontario, lots of parents are paying $2,000 a month per child. 2006, in fact, in downtown Toronto with municipal child care. Across the country, we're looking at, on average, $1,000 to $1,200 a month. We just think that that's too much. It's an extra mortgage. And when you see that young people are starting their lives with massive university debts now, it's not unusual to have a couple with over $100,000 in debt. Well, people are just not getting a chance, and they're not able to start their families when they would like to otherwise. So we think that this is a great measure, and we'll work with the provinces and territories on that. There will, of course, be a goal, and the goal is to create 1 million spaces at the end of 8 years, either maintaining or creating the new ones, and that would take a lot of the pressure off what are invariably very long waiting lists across Canada.
One of the other issues that's been raised is the idea that a universal program, a large-scale program, may end up actually benefiting high-income parents who don't need the help, essentially. Or not sufficiently targeting low-income parents who really need the help. Why not design a program that specifically looks at low-income parents and specifically gets at those families?
That's exactly what some of the provinces might decide to do. In Quebec, for example, I was there. I was a member of the National Assembly when we were putting that program in place over 10 years ago. And that debate took place, and the debate essentially was centered on exactly the point you're making. But it was decided that given the fact that higher-end taxpayers are paying in Quebec over 50% of their income in taxes, we're not going to make them pay twice. They've already paid, therefore, a lot more into the system that costs a lot. But another province could come to a completely different decision. That would be fine. That could be part of the discussion. And we're not, again, we're not about creating single one-size-fits-all solutions across the country.
Did you give any consideration to simply raising the child care expense deduction?
That's one of the things that has been looked at, but it hasn't been touched in years. But it also assumes that you can pay that much. And I think that as an overall social responsibility, there's no reason why so many countries on a par with Canada in terms of gross domestic product per capita and other indicators of wealth are able to put a system like this in place across the country. And we've not been able to. You know, going back to Brian Mulroney, just over 30 years ago, we promised this. The Liberals promised it four elections in a row, beginning with Jean Chrétien's three majorities and then the Paul Martin minority. And they didn't create a single space. Even Stephen Harper discovered the merits of at least talking about child care because he promised precisely 125,000 child care spaces when he got elected the first time in 06. Now, we know what that morphed into, a $100 check and precisely zero child care spaces. So we're going to get it done, Aaron. I think that's the big difference between what's happened for the past 30 years. I've been going across the country for 6 months, meeting with educators, meeting with specialists, meeting with university types, meeting with a lot of parents. And this is meeting with a great deal of approval across the country. There are always things that could be made better. We can look at a program or an idea and say, oh, it could be this or that. But the advantage that we have in the NDP is we've got a great front bench of people with deep experience in public administration who are actually going to get this done. It'll be a priority. And you know what? Governing is about priorities, and this is going to be one of ours, so we're actually going to make it happen.
In terms of paying for it, how much are you banking on corporate tax revenues increasing? Is that the main source of revenue you see going forward? Are you banking on surpluses? Going forward from this point on, where exactly do you see the money coming from?
Well, I know a lot of people would love to see what our first budget's going to look like, but we're also going to have to take the books in the state that they're in when we form government next year. And we don't know all of those details yet. The Conservatives, for example, have talked a good game about surpluses and giving more tax breaks. We've said, first and foremost, as a priority, that money should be paid over to maintaining our healthcare system, which is another NDP program that was brought in Saskatchewan and generalized to the whole country. Free universal public medical care is something we were able to put in place, and we can do the same thing with child care. With regard to the state of the books when we get there, again, we'll see what they are when we arrive, but you're right to point out the corporate tax side. Canada's largest corporations are simply not paying their fair share, whether it's in terms of social programs or our infrastructure, whether it's the courts, the police, education, the roads. I mean, they're the only Canadians not paying their fair share, and we've been very, very straightforward about the fact that we're going to make sure that they get closer to what our main trading partners are making corporations pay there, and we think that that's going to be a fair thing and a good thing.
I know you have raised questions about whether or not the cuts that have been imposed are sustainable. How confident are you that there's going to be extra money lying around between, you know, the budgets of sort of 2016 and onward? Do we risk getting into a situation where lots of promises are made and then you get into government and you decide you actually want to replace some of the cuts that have been made?
Well, precisely because governing is about priorities, the NDP priorities will not be the same as what have been up until now, the Conservative priorities. People can be pretty sure about that. I do know that Mr. Trudeau, in his speech in Montreal earlier this year, said that over the past 35 years, Liberals and Conservatives have had a widely shared agenda. I can assure you that I don't share Stephen Harper's agenda, and we'll be making a lot of choices that are different from his because our priorities are different from his. And that will include reversing some of those ill-considered massive corporate tax reductions. With regard to extra money lying around, I mean, we're experienced public administrators. We know what we have to do, and our choices will be different from theirs. But this is something that we're going to get done. If I read into your question, you know, is it possible that we could come to power and say, oh, you know, the books just don't allow it? The answer is no. Because it's going to be a priority, we'll make it pass before other things, and we'll actually get this done.
That was NDP leader Thomas Mulcair discussing his party's proposed $15 a day childcare program.
You're listening to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Is Justin Trudeau the candidate women have been waiting for? That's the title of an article in Chatelaine Magazine that's created quite a buzz around Ottawa. The profile piece centers around a photo shoot of the Trudeau family, discussing different aspects of the photogenic leader, but it also looks at the party's efforts behind the scenes to nominate women as candidates. Over the years, Chatelaine has done several profiles on political leaders, like in 2007 when it went inside 24 Sussex Drive with Prime Minister Stephen Harper for a piece called At Home with the Harpers.
But the Trudeau article has led to a lot of criticism, with some calling it a patronizing puff piece. To defend her work, Carol Toller, the author of the piece and managing editor of Canadian Business Magazine, speaks with McLean's columnist Emma Title. Now, for full disclosure, McLean's, Chatelaine, and this radio station are all operated by Rogers Media.
Carol, you recently visited Justin Trudeau's home and wrote a piece about your experience for Chatelaine Magazine, which provoked a lot of controversy, specifically on Twitter, from people accusing you of being too soft on Trudeau. Because in addition to the political, you focused on the aesthetic and personal, Trudeau's fashion choices, his fridge magnets, his taste in interior design. Robin Urbach, writing in the National Post, called your story an insult to serious women voters in Canada. What do you make of this backlash?
You know, there have been a lot of comments about the piece, and I have to say, too, while there's been comments that the piece was soft on Trudeau, there were also comments that suggested that it was conservative propaganda, and in fact, we were insulting Trudeau, and that the piece was working counter to the Liberal election campaign. So what it showed for me is, first and foremost, that Justin Trudeau is the most polarizing figure on the Canadian political landscape. From the minute I accepted this assignment, the responses that his name elicited when I mentioned it to people were astonishingly intense, from cab drivers who drove me around Ottawa to staff at the hotel who heard that I was going to interview Justin Trudeau, who just immediately responded with, cool, amazing, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then I had friends who heard that I was going to be interviewing him, and their response was, ooh. I don't think there's much of a middle ground with him, so people will bring that to whatever they read about Justin Trudeau, and I really think that's part of what was playing into the whole discussion and debate around my piece. Mm-hmm. That said, there is a question of how much of a politician's personal life and personal attributes belong in a piece about a politician and someone who ultimately wants to become the Prime Minister of Canada. I think one thing that's really important to remember is that this is not a time when it's even possible to do a definitive political profile of Justin Trudeau. He hasn't released an election platform, and there are big questions looming over him right now about what he stands for. Right now, he's all about imaging. That's simply the fact of his campaign at this point. He's got to start rolling out very clear party positions, and I think that'll start shifting some of the debate. But we found it interesting to explore his image, what he's trying to project, and why, mm-hmm. because it's very apparent, and the party makes no bones about it, they do want to target women voters. So was this piece a political profile? I wouldn't even call it that. I would say it was meant to be, always, a peek inside the highly choreographed world that is Justin Trudeau mm-hmm. and his family. And it was also meant to expose some of the imagery that he is very consciously and deliberately projecting. And if you mm-hmm. say that personal details don't belong as part of that, I would say, how do we know that Stephen Harper is a great jazz pianist? And why do we know that he loves playing Beatles standards? Nobody seems to object to those stories or those front page photos, and we've certainly mm-hmm. seen plenty of those.
Chatelaine is also a lifestyle magazine, right? And so, I mean, it's normal that you would do some of the aesthetic reporting as well as the political. Like, if I was to open a Chatelaine, I wouldn't really want to read some breakdown of the deficit, you know? I'd like to know about Justin Trudeau's habit of not wearing socks with his khakis.
Well, that's the interesting question, right? And that's – women are grappling with that right now, and it's a great debate to have. What belongs in a women's magazine? How much substance versus how much style? Everyone has an opinion on it, and I think the answer is constantly shifting, and it should. Mm-hmm. And I think at some point we do need to talk about the substantive political issues in this election campaign. But I don't think that negates interest in politicians as human beings. We do relate to them as human beings. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, there's this interesting thing that happens with social media in particular where you're not publishing a piece in Chatelaine magazine anymore. You're sending it out to the world. And readers of Maclean's and readers of the National Post and readers of all kinds of other publications that, frankly, would probably like to have had some of this access and would certainly have had things to say of their own about Justin Trudeau will say, well, this wasn't the right piece. This isn't what I would have written. This isn't what should have appeared in my publication. Well, I didn't write it for their publication.
Do you think there's also a double standard where women's issues are concerned, or let's say Stephen Harper were to give an interview to Hockey News, nobody would probably, you know, be upset with Hockey News for not ripping into Harper about Attawapiskat, right? We accept that when you're doing an when a politician is being interviewed by a niche magazine or a lifestyle magazine, that you're not going to get this hard-hitting political reporting.
Yeah, I think there is absolutely a double standard. And I think at the same time, the converse of that is that it's unfortunate that there aren't more publications that are reflecting women in other ways. I think part of this backlash, if you want to call it that, is just that women don't like seeing themselves reduced to a sort of trivial level, as if all they're interested in is the personal details. And I think the reason some people have responded strongly to that is more that what they're looking for is some public acknowledgement that women care about big issues too. And I tried to work that into the piece and certainly quoted people who said that they now feel more interested in seeing what Justin Trudeau has to say about economic issues and transit and healthcare now that they know that he supports pro-choice, which is an issue that's important to many women. So, yeah, I think it's more a sort of yearning for substantive political discussion than a feeling that the sort of piece that Chatelaine ran shouldn't appear. It's we need to see more across the spectrum of women's perspectives.
Do you think sometimes the Liberals take their courting of women voters too far? Like last, for example, last November's Justin Trudeau's Ladies' Night?
Yeah. I think all of this stuff is tricky ground for a politician to tread. And I certainly had what's the best term? The Ladies' Night marketing made me uncomfortable. The whole packaging of it just was a little too light, and the term ladies, for instance, right away gets my back up. I think it pigeonholed women a bit. I spoke to Katie Telford, the campaign co-chair, about that event, and unfortunately this didn't make it into the piece, but she acknowledged that that branding isn't necessarily the branding that they're trying to send out with Trudeau, and that this was an event that was organized by some women who aren't typically engaged in the world of politics and wanted to bring more women into this sort of big tent that many believe Trudeau is trying to form. And she really felt that it succeeded in that way. I mean, I think, again, what we need to acknowledge is there is no monolithic female voting bloc, right? We don't all vote the same way. What we react against is when we're pigeonholed in this one narrow little way, and that event seemed to do that. But I think there are other ways that Trudeau is trying to appeal to women in sort of fresh new ways that probably are laudable and worth paying attention to.
That was Maclean's columnist Emma Teitel speaking with Carol Toller, the managing editor of Canadian Business Magazine and the author of the Chatelaine article on Liberal leader Justin Trudeau. For more on this story, head to Maclean's.ca.
Still to come on the show, the Supreme Court begins its hearings into the legal challenge on assisted suicide, and the Maclean's panel weighs in on NDP daycare and the Chatelaine controversy. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes joins us for the Maclean's panel. But first, the debate over assisted suicide is now in the hands of the country's top judges. The Supreme Court held hearings this week on the controversial topic thanks to a case that stems from a 2011 legal challenge to our current ban on physician-assisted death. The case was launched on behalf of two terminally ill women who have since died. A ruling isn't expected for at least the next 6 months.
The assisted suicide case brings into play deep legal and ethical questions. To sort out some of the key issues, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes talked with University of Ottawa law professor Carissa Mamathan. Professor Mathen explains what led the BC trial judge to overturn the ban on assisted suicide in the first place, and the government's argument to keep the status quo.
The trial judge did an exhaustive review of thousands of pages of evidence, many dozens of witnesses, and concluded that while the risk can never be reduced to zero, the risk of wrongfully killing people can be mitigated and managed in such a way that the absolute ban is simply no longer justified. And because the trial judge's findings in that regard, her review of the facts, are entitled to respect and deference by higher courts, the federal government had to find another way to attack those findings. So first of all, it tried to say that the trial judge simply misused the evidence, but it also said that the trial judge overstepped her bounds in engaging in what it called a legislative exercise. The problem is that when you have a charter right that involves a weighing of society's interests in a particular issue, it's never going to be a straight legal analysis.
There's always going to be actual facts and research, that not just an interpretation of the law, but some kind of a probe into what we know about real facts, how people live, how society is shaped, is changing. Is that right?
Exactly right. So the interpretation of our charter rights doesn't happen in a vacuum. It requires an appreciation of the surrounding context, which will include just basic social phenomena. And the existence of particular risks and the existence of particular systems that can manage that risk that the government needs to take into account. So, yes, there is always the it's always, in a sense, easy, in particularly in these very divisive cases, to say that the courts are getting into really the role of Parliament, what it's Parliament's job to do. But particularly when you're talking about a really profound personal liberty here and something that really affects your autonomy, the courts have to get into that balancing in order to ensure that our constitutional rights are respected.
That was University of Ottawa law professor Carissima Mathen in conversation with Maclean's Ottawa bureau chief John Geddes.
Now, the Supreme Court justices in this case definitely gave the government a hard time, but that's potentially good news to one conservative MP. Stephen Fletcher is a quadriplegic who has been fighting for the right to die for a long time. While his party doesn't support it, the Manitoba MP has a private member's bill before Parliament which is aimed at legalizing assisted suicide. I was able to speak with Mr. Fletcher in his office just outside the House of Commons to get his reaction to the Supreme Court hearings.
First of all, just to recap for our listeners, we want to know where you stand on the issue of doctor-assisted suicide. Why do you feel it's necessary to make that legal, albeit with restrictions, but why do you think it should be legal in Canada?
First, I call it physician-assisted death. Suicide has so much baggage associated with the word, but I support physician-assisted death in unique circumstances when an individual is a competent mind, experiencing tremendous pain, and I believe that if a competent adult wants to make an adult decision about their lives and, or how to end their lives, they should be able to. And in too many cases, it's not something that someone can do themselves, so they need assistance. And that assistance can appropriately come from a physician.
Now, you yourself have a personal issue with this after your crash in 1996. What thoughts and what reflections did you have after the crash, when you were waking up and coming to grips with what had happened to you?
I hit a moose with my car. I was 23 years old, had a great life plan, and of course, the car accident left me a quadriplegic. And to spare the gory details, it was a terrifying experience, not knowing if I was able to take the next breath, and then being told about what likely my fate was going to be, some institution somewhere. And that is not what a 23-year-old wants to hear. I was in a very dire situation. I would have found comfort in knowing that I would be able to end my life or have that choice if things went south on me.
Did you contemplate it at all? Did it pass through your mind? Were these thoughts that you had at that time?
The answer is yes. You know, we're all human beings, and C4 quadriplegia is about as disabled as you can get and still be alive. And it was done in an instant, so there was no adjustment period. And you have to, you know, obviously you have to reflect on what is the difference between life and living. I decided to fight and pursue as much as I could as I was going to before, and got an MBA and meandered my way into student politics, provincial politics, and then finally federal politics. And so that has given me a purpose-driven life, though not the life I would have chose.
Now that our listeners know where you're coming from on this subject, you were there at the Supreme Court listening to the arguments from both sides of the issue. What did you think of the hearings in front of our country's top judges?
They were fascinating, very interesting. And I think on this issue, it's one of the few issues that I think any Canadian could follow what the essence of the conversation was. And it was essentially, what does it mean to be alive? What is the state's responsibility to keep people alive? And what resources are required to do that? And individual autonomy. I found it very telling when one of the Supreme Court judges straight out asked the government lawyers who were defending the status quo, does the law, the prohibition, as it now stands, lead to people suffering? The government lawyer said, yes. The Supreme Court justice then asked, does the law as it now stands lead people to take their lives prematurely because they are afraid that if they lose that ability to take their own life, that they will be in dire straits? And the answer was yes. So the government lawyers agree that the current prohibition does lead to suffering and does lead to premature death. We all agree with that. So what's the problem?
And that sort of leads me to ask you what your reaction is to the arguments from the federal lawyers. They got a pretty rough ride yesterday from the Supreme Court justices.
Well, my first reaction was, I am really glad that I'm not standing where those government lawyers are standing, because they were clobbered. In fact, I think it was the lunch break that saved one of them. But
Mr. Frater, Rob Frater.
Rob Frater, yeah. Poor Rob Frater. But, you know, I thought, and the other government lawyer, Ms. Nygaard, I thought she spoke very eloquently. But, again, we're asked, you know, fundamental questions about being alive, and essentially they said, yeah, we'll accept suffering. We will accept other people's suffering to keep this archaic law enforced. That is not where Canadians want to go.
Given everything that you heard in the Supreme Court hearings and the way that the federal lawyers, as you put it, were clobbered, where do you think this case is going to go?
I'd rather predict the lotto number for 649, then, and I'll be more accurate than ever guessing what the Supreme Court is going to do. It's a fool's errand. But you've asked the question, and some people in the opposition would say I am a fool, so I'll answer it. The issue, I think, will come back to Parliament at the direction of the Supreme Court, perhaps with some guidelines. The Chief Justice, Beverly McLaughlin, is the only member that is on the bench, that was on the bench when the Sue Rodriguez hearing was heard, and she was part of the dissenting four in that decision. So we know where she stands on the issue.
Justice Abella and Cromwell were also a part of that questioning and yes. What seemed like criticism of the federal argument.
Yes, they were. They asked pointed questions. Just because judges ask pointed questions, I mean, in enough hearings, you cannot predict an outcome based on the questions. You just cannot do that.
That was Conservative MP Stephen Fletcher discussing doctor-assisted suicide. He also gives more personal reflections and discusses the political tactics he's using to try and get his private member's bill on the issue passed before the next election. To listen to the full interview, go to mcleans.ca.
Coming up on Maclean's on the Hill, Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes joins the Maclean's panel to discuss the daycare plan from the NDP and the controversy over a Chatelaine article about Justin Trudeau's efforts to woo women voters.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined as always by my co-host on Maclean's on the Hill, Aaron Wary, the Associate Editor of Maclean's Magazine, and the Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
All right, we're going to talk about NDP daycare, and later on we're going to discuss this whole Chatelaine Magazine article about Justin Trudeau and the controversy surrounding that. But first off, on this $15 a day daycare plan that the NDP has put forward. John, do you think that this is a good policy that the NDP is putting forward, something that can really connect with voters?
I wouldn't say it's a home run, but there's sort of two parts to your question, right? Is it something that will connect with voters, and is it good policy? I think it is something that could connect with voters, particularly if you want to really cut some slice the demographic a bit here, left of center women. A part of the electorate that the NDP has relied on in many parts of the country, and that the conventional wisdom is that Justin Trudeau has siphoned away from them to a large degree. So there's a definite target audience here, and in that respect, I think it's smart politics. As a design of policy, I think it's a little hard to know what to say about it because Thomas Mulcair was so open-ended about what he would allow the policy to be. Essentially, anything the provinces say, he's basically open to. He was very conscious in his media availability in this to talk about how flexible they are. So it's hard to know, you know, how to frame the thing when he's being so open-ended. Like, is it a good policy or bad policy? Well, we don't really know what the policy is. Essentially, what we know is there'd be a big envelope of money on the table, there'd be negotiations with the provinces, and somehow the money would hopefully go to building daycare places. I think that's, frankly, a pretty vague starting point for the debate.
And the starting point on this issue itself, it seems like they've gotten some good press out of it, which
Absolutely.
Is what they're looking for.
Absolutely.
So let's turn to the risks of the daycare plan. Aaron, you actually were able to interview Thomas Mulcair, and there are some criticisms coming about costing of this. I mean, they're claiming in 2023 it's going to be costing $5 billion annually. The government wants to know how they think that they can pay for this sort of program, and also, I mean, costing that far in advance seems a little bit ridiculous at this point. But what are some of the risks, and how are the NDP responding to the criticisms that have come forward?
Well, I think the NDP's line, I think Mr. Mulcair's line, is simply that this will be a priority and they will find a way to fund this. And how you view that, it depends on a couple things. First, do you think they can get that money in corporate tax revenue? And maybe if it's only $1.9 billion or whatever it is in year four or year five, then, you know, maybe that's conceivable. The other is, what exactly are the books going to look like for the next 5 years? As Stephen Gordon has written for us a few times, you know, if you want to go along with the government's understanding that there are going to be surpluses, you have to agree with the government's view on how the budget has been balanced. So you have to agree with the government's cuts. So the real danger, I think, here is that a government comes in and a new government comes in 2015 and looks at the books and goes, well, actually, we don't really like some of these cuts. These cuts aren't sustainable. The public's upset about this or that, so we have to start managing the books differently. And suddenly those surpluses start to go away really fast. Now, Mulcair's response to that seems to be, childcare is a priority for us. This is a priority for us. We will find a way to make this work. And that, I think, is... That alone, at this point, I think, is enough of a message for the public. If you look at this as a simple message exercise for the public, the view right now is the NDP wants to fund childcare, the Conservatives don't want to fund childcare, they want to continue with the childcare benefit, and the Liberals kind of want to fund childcare, but they don't have a plan. As a short-term political move, I think this is very advantageous for the NDP, at least as a branding exercise and as getting an idea across of who Thomas Mulcair is and what the NDP would do.
Hmm. And, of course, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, John, they're trying to appeal to women voters. And that's something that has sort of popped up with this Chatelaine article on Justin Trudeau. And I guess full disclosure for our viewers and listeners, Chatelaine is a Rogers publication, and Maclean's, as well as Rogers Radio, obviously, are under the same parent company. But this Chatelaine article, which was just sort of a profile, a look at Trudeau, a behind-the-scenes thing of how he loves the camera and can dresses without socks and wears loafers. And, you know, you're looking at the person themselves, and there's a lot of criticism about this. Some people are calling it patronizing and an insult to women. So are the criticisms overblown on this, or are they valid?
Let me take a shot at this way, Cormac. In 2009, the fall of 2009, the Prime Minister sat at a piano on the stage of the National Arts Centre here and played With Little Help From My Friends. And I went back and looked at some of the coverage of that moment from that time. We covered it big in Maclean's. The Globe and Mail reported that it wasn't concocted by spin doctors. It was dreamt up between the Prime Minister and his wife and was a sort of an authentic moment. A CBC reporter said he wowed the audience, and there was a lot of breathless, gushy coverage of that. It was, I would argue at the time, a kind of communications coup. But did we hear a lot of people saying, what is wrong with the media? Why are we so guilelessly covering this this moment? Like, why don't we take a more critical look at how it's been? We didn't really do that. I think there's a hunger in a sort of fast-paced media business to leaven the sort of hardcore political reporting, policy reporting. I mean, we've been talking about child care policy here, with lighter stuff that humanizes the subjects. And I think that crosses political dividing lines, party and ideological dividing lines. The Prime Minister has benefited from some very nice coverage of exactly that type. So a little bit much to somewhat complain that this is a Trudeau phenomena, that it's just because... Now, here's the degree to which it is a Trudeau phenomena. He's good at it. He's very good at it. And to sort of say, no fair, he's playing the same game we are, but he's better at it than we are, is not a very convincing position to take. So I think that everyone's going to have to take a breather here and go, look, there are going to be light, uncritical profile lifestyle pieces about public figures, including politicians. That's the way it rolls. If you could plausibly argue that it's very one-sided, then that would be an interesting argument. But I don't think you can plausibly argue that at this point. So I say it's fair ball.
And this week we saw the Prime Minister on Hockey Night in Canada.
Absolutely.
Doing another sort of fluff piece, but about hockey and targeting the audience that he wants to do. And then we saw Thomas Mulcair with the NDP on a program called The Social. Should we expect more of this as we move forward over the next year, this sort of way to try and personalize these politicians?
Yeah, I think, to a certain degree, I don't think what happened with Mr. Trudeau and Chatelaine is really all that unique or novel. I mean, politicians are covered in a variety of ways, and some of them are more or less serious than others. If the conclusion we've come to after yesterday is that all coverage of politicians must be serious, rigorous, critical policy analysis. Right. Fantastic. I can't wait.
Good week for policy options,
for example. I guess we've all decided we're going to be academic journals now, which is fine. To a certain extent, I think that's valid, that we should be demanding things of people. But I think we have to kind of relax a bit, that periodically there are going to be articles that aren't going to be super, super intense on policy. You know, I think there are a few things feeding this. One is the narrative that Justin Trudeau is not a serious person. So when a story comes out that suggests that doesn't cover him seriously, it feeds into that. The second is the conservative narrative that the media is too nice to Mr. Trudeau. So that fed into this too, like, oh, here we go again, the mainstream media falling over itself for Trudeau. The other thing I think, and I hate to sound like a 90-year-old fuddy-duddy, but I think Twitter comes into this. I think Twitter makes it, everyone wants to join in the outrage of the day and get all wound up over something. And so, you know, these little tempests come up and everybody freaks out for 8 hours, and then we all forget about it and move on to the next thing. You know, I think Chatelaine, and, you know, by all means, you know, there are corporate cousins, I guess, so maybe I could be accused of bias here, but I think they're getting a bad rap for the story. I think the story was fairly self-aware of what was going on there. You know, is there a story to be written about, you know, what policies should women voters be thinking about, by all means? But this isn't anything new or novel or strange. Like, this happens, I mean, you know, as it was pointed out last night by one of Mr. Trudeau's advisors, you know, Chatelaine did a spread on the Harper family before. Like, this isn't, we're all sort of freaking out without any kind of sense of exactly why we're freaking out.
And Chatelaine is a lifestyle magazine, so they're not going to be focusing heavily on policy when it's a lifestyle magazine, just as much as Sportsnet magazine or a hockey publication, Hockeynet in Canada, is talking to the Prime Minister. They're not going to ask him about hard questions on Iraq and the mission with ISIS, against ISIS. Yeah. They're going to ask him about hockey. That's the point of that program.
Did Aaron just tell Twitter to get off of his lawn? Is that how I heard that? Something along those lines. On this point about you know, what's good, what's bad coverage, there is such a thing as good and bad lifestyle coverage as well, right? I mean, if someone covers something to do with someone's hobbies or personal interests or what they do, and it's proven to be not true, right? Well, like all reporting, if it's not true, you shouldn't be reporting it, right? So when you've got someone who's claiming that, I've occasionally seen, for example, people make claims about people's reading or movie watching habits where I suspected it wasn't true, you know? So when you put a question to a politician and say, what kind of books do you read? And the politician said, I read Greek philosophy and the original Greek. I also read presidential biographies, you know, and you realize, you know, I've been around this guy and on the planes and stuff. I've never seen him with a book of Greek philosophy or a presidential article. What I've seen him with is, you know, lighter fare than that. Then you just shouldn't report that, right? This seems like a trivial thing, but it's like all reporting. If you're reporting on someone's lifestyle, their personal things, you have to, you know, test it against what you think is accurate. That Chatelaine piece didn't have anything that I thought sounded like inaccurate coverage.
Thanks very much, guys. Appreciate it. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, joined as always by my co-host on Macleans on the Hill, Aaron Wary, and Ottawa Bureau Chief for Macleans, John Geddes.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.